little forewarning of combat or sexual assault statistics, or that faculty of color somehow never become department chairs, or that the mostly female non-professional staff is being paid bupkis and forbidden to unionize, or that fraternities are defending brothers against sexual assault charges by threatening to bring libel suits against the women who report them, or that a newly out lesbian basketball coach has to take a monitoring faculty member along on team travels, or that a law school professor is famous for asking only female students about cases with a sexual component, or that a male medical school professor hires prostituted women on whom to demonstrate gynecological exams, or that the football team spends a lot on AstroTurf, but not on preventing brain injury, and many other indicators of a need for change. In short, serious politics are happening right here on campus. After visiting a class or two, maybe having dinner with student leaders and faculty, where I find out still more about what's happening on campus, we go to the lecture hall. There we discover that it's already full, and people are waiting outside. Perhaps someone is hooking up a public address system for the overflow, or people are being put into rooms with closed-circuit television, and paper is being handed out so they can send in their comments for the post-lecture discussion. In the same way that individual women are often underestimated, a movement of women is also underestimated. But the truth is that if people realize someone is willing to talk about these deep and daily concerns, they show up. Now the organizers are apologetic for thinking too small. Public opinion polls have long proved there is majority support for pretty much every issue that the women's movement has brought up. But those of us, women or men, who identify with feminism are still made to feel isolated, wrong, out of step. At first, feminists were assumed to be only discontented suburban housewives, then a small bunch of women's libbers, bra burners, and radicals, then women on welfare, then briefcase-carrying imitations of male executives, then unfulfilled women who forgot to have children, then women voters responsible for a gender gap that really could decide elections. That last was too dangerous, so suddenly we were told we were in a post-feminist age, so we would relax, stop, quit. Indeed, the common purpose in all these disparate and contradictory descriptions is to slow and stop a challenge to the current hierarchy. But controversy is a teacher. The accusation that feminism is bad for the family leads to understanding that it's bad for the patriarchal variety, but good for democratic families that are the basis of democracy. The idea that women are our own worst enemies forces us to admit that we don't have the power to be, even if we wanted to. When occasionally a lecture hall has to be emptied and searched after an anti-abortion group has sent in a bomb threat, I've noticed that when we return, the audience has grown bigger out of support. So far, I've also noticed that if an audience is half women and half men, women worry about the reaction of the men around them. But in one that is two-thirds women and one-third men, women respond as they would on their own, and men hear women speaking honestly. When people of color are in the majority instead of the minority, audiences are often the best education that white listeners can have. Sometimes hostility shows up, and that is educational in itself. Without campuses in the Bible Belt, I wouldn't know that the belief that women's subordinate role is ordained by God is still with us, or that it can take courage for a student from a strict Christian family or Jewish or Muslim equivalent to go to any college that doesn't teach the New Testament, the Old Testament, or the Quran as the literal truth. A student from Bob Jones University who sought counseling there after being sexually assaulted was asked to repent, as if she had attracted the assault. In Texas, I saw people outside an auditorium where I was about to speak. Because their signs called me a humanist, I assumed they were welcoming, until a former fundamentalist explained to me that because humanism is bad and secular, Christians were demonstrating against my speech. In some audiences, feminism is blamed for, say, divorce or plummeting birth rates or lower salaries, instead of blaming unequal marriage or lack of childcare or employers who profiteer. But this is an education, too. People who arrive assuming that no one could possibly disagree with equal pay may learn otherwise from someone who rises to say that the free market takes care of that. Unequal pay just means that women aren't worth as much as employees. Anyone who believes we're living in a post-feminist age will learn that violence against females, from female infanticide and child marriage to honor killings and sex trafficking, has now produced a world with fewer females than males, a first in recorded history. On the other hand, hearing men say they want to humanize the masculine role that is literally killing them and that they want to raise their own children keeps all those present from measuring progress by what was and raises a new standard, what could be. Altogether, I've seen enough change to have faith that more will come. It's 1971, and I'm just beginning to talk about the women's movement, with Dorothy, not yet on my own, when I get an invitation to give the address at the Harvard Law Review banquet. This annual event is reserved for top students, and guest speakers tend to be political leaders or prestigious legal scholars. Definitely all men. Once I discover this isn't a practical joke, it's an easy no. I tell them the woman they should ask is Ruth Bader Ginsburg, a brilliant lawyer who was one of the first female students at Harvard Law School and who has just created the first women's rights project at the American Civil Liberties Union. Then I get a call from Brenda Feigen, a friend who also was one of the early women at Harvard Law and who now runs the Women's Rights Project with Ruth. She says I have to do it. Ruth will never be asked because she left Harvard to go to Columbia Law School, and besides, if I say no, they may go back to men as usual. Brenda promises to help with research and to ask current women law students to do the same. I remind her that my fear of public speaking is just as serious as her fear of flying, but she says I can write every word, and it will be more like reading than speaking. This and other arguments finally make me say yes to my worst nightmare. This is how I find myself on the Harvard campus with Brenda, interviewing women who make up just 7% of its law students. I learn that the segregated tradition of Ladies' Day, the only time when women are called on in class, has only just ended, and that the faculty are still 100% white and male. So sure of themselves are the powers that be that the sign over the men's room in the library stacks just says, Faculty. I write this all down and become even more nervous. These students are depending on me. Ultimately, I find myself standing at a podium in Boston's Sheraton Plaza Hotel. The Harvard Club of Boston, where the banquet is usually held, makes women enter through a side door. I look down at the long 1930s dress I found in a thrift shop and see its velvet skirt vibrating slightly due to my shaking knees. I'm not sure how much this nervousness is audible in my voice. Brenda is pretending I'm fine. This is a piece of cake. But 27 years later, Ira Lupu, then a third-year Harvard Law student in the audience, will write his remembrance. Her delivery was rhetorically unimpressive. She seemed nervous and spoke quietly and without sharp effect or physical punctuation. He didn't know the half of it. My speech is called Why Harvard Law School Needs Women More Than Women Need It. I managed to get through the main part, arguing that only equality creates respect for the law and that only democratic families create democracy. Yet I know that the audience knows that women law students have provided ammunition. Interviewing them has already created resentful rumblings among the faculty, and I launch into their testimony at the end. With this humanist vision in mind, you can imagine how a female human being suffers at Harvard Law School. She spends much of her time feeling lonely, since male classmates often regard her as a freak. She spends the rest of it feeling mad as hell. Much more seriously, the catalog betrays no interest in her half of the human race. There is a course on racism and American law, but none on sexism. There is a course on international whaling law, but none on women's rights internationally. An eminent professor of administrative law said as late as last night that he didn't know what the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission was. The same man replied to a request that at least one female full-time professor be hired by answering that women faculty brought problems because of sexual vibrations. And an eminent securities law expert used descriptions of stupid widows and wives to explain sample cases of stock loss. Professors may joke about the reasonable man test, explaining that there is no such thing as a reasonable woman. They may describe rape as a very small assault, gape at bosoms and legs in the front row, encourage the hissing and booing from male colleagues that often follow a female colleague's classroom remarks on women's rights, and use stupid woman stories or sex jokes that humiliate women to illustrate some legal point. From now on, no man can call himself liberal or radical or even a conservative advocate of fair play if his work depends in any way on the unpaid or underpaid labor of women at home or in the office. Politics don't begin in Washington. Politics begin with those who are oppressed right here. I'm so relieved to be finished that I can't tell whether the applause is approving, disapproving, or just polite. But then, something happens that, I will later learn, is unprecedented. A portly man in a tuxedo rises from his table, his face flushed with anger, and protests not the content of what I have said, but the very idea that I dare to judge Harvard Law School at all. I don't know who he is, but I definitely know he's outraged. When he finally sits down, there is silence in the ballroom, then talk gradually resumes like an ocean covering a volcano. Later, Brenda tells me this was Vernon Countryman, a Harvard Law professor of debtor-creditor relations. I'm unsure whether to be scared or proud of his response, yet something tells me it's more the latter. He has embodied what women at Harvard Law School are dealing with. Only decades later will that law student in the audience confirm my feeling in the moment. I remember being shocked that a Harvard law professor could publicly appear so incoherent and out of control, Ira Lupu wrote. His remarks seemed designed to put Steinem in her place as a young woman untutored in the facts and values of the Harvard Law School, rather than to rebut her comments in any rigorous way. The banquet ended with the quietly held yet widespread sense that countrymen had underlined Steinem's theme of male boorishness and disrespect for women in a way that her words alone could not do. Finally, Lupu solved the mystery of why I was invited in the first place. His belated essay explains that his then-wife, Jana Sachs, had felt profound alienation from the principles and methods reflected in her spouse's legal education. She suggested me as a speaker, and the president of the Harvard Law Review said yes. We each played a role. A wife, women law students, Brenda, me, even the angry professor. In this way, Harvard Law School gives me a big gift. I worry less about hostile responses. Ultimately, they educate an audience. As the great Flo Kennedy will suggest later when we begin to speak together, just pause. Let the audience absorb the hostility, then say, I didn't pay him to say that. It's 1972, and Margaret Sloan and I are traveling to Texas campuses. One is East Texas State University, where future farmers study agriculture, and another is Southern Methodist University in Dallas, where future leaders study whatever they please. Yet as different as they are, a pair of women students approach us afterward with the same passionate message in each place. If you think this is bad, you should come to Texas Women's University. Each pair is also one white woman and one black woman, unusual in itself. Back home in New York, we keep hearing from more TWU students. It's a campaign to get us there without a speaker's program to pay expenses, at least without one willing to invite us. Who can resist? Denton turns out to be a small town known for its rodeos and hot summers. Students take us around the campus of low buildings, plus one tower that is topped by the president's office, like a warden's eyrie overlooking a prison, as the students point out. The good news about this state-supported women's university is that its low cost invites women who might never otherwise be able to go to college, including Black and Latina students. The not-so-good news is that TWU is known for two specialties. One is domestic science, which was originally a way of elevating women's work in the home, but has become a field that students feel is training them for marriage or domestic service jobs. The other is nursing, the most organized of the professions that are mostly female, but it is still paid less than such similar but mostly male professions as pharmacy. The worst news is that the many sexual assaults on campus have been met with fences, curfews, and male guards that restrict the victims but not the victimizers. In fact, students suspect that a couple of the guards are the rapists. Margaret and I find ourselves in TWU's main auditorium. It is packed with students and exploding with new feminism, combined with civil rights and Black power, plus the newly founded La Raza Unida, a national party created by Mexican-American leaders in Texas. Already, La Raza has confounded expectations by becoming the first national political party to support reproductive freedom, including abortion. Many of the students have experienced the double discrimination of sex and race, not only in the mainstream, but also by race in the women's movement, and by sex in the Black power movement. They applaud when Margaret says, "I still have scars on my head and dust between my toes from marching across that bridge in Selma. Once I was left for dead, but when the organizing began, they asked me to make coffee." They laugh with relief when she says, "I want to make sure that when the revolution comes, I'm not cooking grits for it." As she sums up, "I'm not Black on Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, and a woman on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday." Since many have also been raised with traditional Southern ideas of womanhood, they also cheer when I talk about women feeling like a half person without a man standing next to them, whether on Saturday night or throughout life. This would surprise men, too, I explain, if they realized how little it matters which man is standing there. More laughter and cries of "tell it." They're glad to hear what a Black woman once said to her white Southern sisters: "A pedestal is as much a prison as any small space." Though some in the audience yell out objections to Margaret's sprinkling of four-letter words, after all, she is a poet from the South Side of Chicago, she gets applause when she says that if critics don't like the way she talks, they can leave. When someone asks if I believe in God and I say no, I believe in people, I get a hushed silence. So I go on. If in monotheism, God is man, man is God. Why does God look suspiciously like the ruling class? Why is Jesus, a Jewish guy from the Middle East, blonde and blue-eyed? There is a relieved response of laughter and even a few shouts of "tell it." At the end, the student organizers give us the highest praise. The result has been worth the year they spent persuading us to come. We have made them look reasonable by comparison. Home in New York, we read newspaper clippings from Denton that sum up our subject matter as sexism, racism, job discrimination, children, welfare, abortion, homosexuality, bisexuality, in a discussion described as emotional, controversial, thought-provoking, relevant. There are also quotes from audience members who call this lecture and discussion embarrassing and the worst thing I've ever heard. It seems that people went away either angry or inspired. For Margaret, it's a proof of need that helps her decide to co-found the National Black Feminist Organization, together with Eleanor Holmes Norton from the EEOC, Jane Galvin Lewis of the Women's Action Alliance, artist Faith Ringgold, author Michelle Wallace, and many others. After Margaret moves to Oakland, she keeps organizing and working in women's centers there. When I visit her, we reminisce about the 24 campuses we visited together in less than 1 year, but our conversation always comes back to TWU. 35 years pass before I'm back on that campus again. This time I'm campaigning for Hillary Clinton in her 2008 primary race for the presidency and speaking together with Jemu Green, a young African-American woman who, like me, has decided after much soul-searching to campaign for Clinton because of her longer experience in battling the ultra-right wing and to support Obama in the future. Now this campus is offering a master's degree in women's studies, though many others still don't offer even a women's studies major. Rarer still, TWU will soon offer a PhD. It also encourages men as well as women to enter its nursing program. Most unusual, a student cannot graduate without taking a course in multicultural women's studies. No wonder Oprah Winfrey has spoken here twice. Except for a library still famous for its cookbook collection, the campus bears little resemblance to the past. After our brief talks and a lively discussion about getting out the vote, one woman comes up to tell me that she was on campus when Margaret and I were here decades ago. She calls our visit shock therapy that began a year of organizing. The TWU human rights movement forced the administration to deal with student grievances, took on sexism and racism together, and is now working with undocumented immigrants in North Texas. I have to tell her that Margaret, who moved with her daughter to California about a year after we were at TWU, died after a long illness at only 57. Her daughter held a memorial in California, and together we organized one in New York. It's hard to believe that Margaret isn't here on this campus where she was once so alive. You know the hospital shows on television, this woman asks, when someone's heart stops and has to be restarted with electric paddles? That's what you and Margaret did for us. Please tell her daughter our hearts have been going ever since. We learn most where we know the least. For me, this means Gallaudet University in Washington, D.C., the only institution of higher learning in the world that is designed for students who are deaf. It's a revelation. I arrived there in 1983 to spend a day meeting students, then giving a lecture in the evening. Aside from the fact that I need an interpreter, this campus seems like any other. Students ask me how we started Ms. Magazine, since they're thinking of starting a magazine on campus. I ask them about the courses they love. There is a controversy about the presidency. Students want a role in choosing the next one so they at last will have a leader who is also deaf and understands their world. We talk about tactics for making that happen, from petitions to tuition strikes. I see that it's harder to take risks when there is no other campus like the one you're on, yet they're determined. Like more than 80% of the students here, those I meet come from hearing families, and they value this short time of being with people who share their experience and culture. I know enough to look at the person speaking to me, not at the interpreter who is making sign language audible for my benefit. I have the feeling of understanding and being understood. But the more time I spend with Gallaudet students, the more I enter into a world where liveliness of expression is a universal art form. Because their words are kinetic and their faces expressive, I feel as if I'm fully present in conversation in a rare way. I know how much I would be missing without a signer as the bridge, but an effort is being made to include me. Young women tell me how misinterpreted they feel in, say, a room full of hearing men, given the stereotype of deaf women as doubly helpless, no matter how strong they really are. I learn how much less likely a deaf woman is, statistically speaking, to be employed or married or in a long-term relationship, even less than her male counterparts, given this double standard. Yet both the men and women are so fast, subtle, and nuanced in talking to me and to each other that I feel as if my audible words are like bricks, and their visual ones are seashells and feathers. Ever since Judy Heumann and other disability activists made the point of inclusion in Houston in 1977, feminist speakers have been better about asking that a meeting provide signing and be wheelchair accessible, although it doesn't always happen. At Gallaudet, however, There is not just one signer where the audience can see him or her and I cannot, but one on each side of the stage, and also on each of a dozen or so special platforms around the audience. This means I can see a chorus of motion while I'm speaking. There is also the signing of lyrics and poetry. It's like watching a ballet, a democratic ballet that everyone could learn if we tried. By the time I leave the signing world for the world of the hearing, I'm not quite the same person. I've seen an expressive, visual world that isn't like the one I've been walking around in. Coming home, I feel let down. Where are all those expressive people? 5 years later, I read that the student movement there, with the wonderfully direct name Deaf President Now, has succeeded. In 1988, Gallaudet University finally hires its first deaf president and even appoints a first deaf chair of its board of trustees. This is a long overdue victory on a campus where Abraham Lincoln authorized the first degrees. I also see that on other campuses, activists are framing deafness and disability as a civil rights issue, not as a medical problem that needs fixing. They are developing a whole new field called disability studies. Like black studies and women's studies, these programs begun by a social justice movement are about changing the system to fit people, not the other way around. Since disability may be a state that people both enter and leave, from skiing accidents to combat injuries, from giving birth to aging in crutches, ramps instead of steps turn out to be important to most people at some time in their lives. A few are even citing the 360 million deaf people in the world, or the million in this country, and studying sign language as a language requirement. Will we get to the point that learning sign language is a part of literacy? That knowing both an audible and a physical language is routine? Thanks to those Gallaudet students, I can imagine it. On campuses that offer courses in hospitality training or hotel management, visitors often stay in a hotel that is a practice lab for students. I'm having coffee in the lobby of one in the Midwest when a tall, rangy, fair-haired young man in cowboy boots asks if he can sit down. Because he seems so shy and because he says he has long admired both me and a particular professional baseball player, I'm surprised. Never before have I been so paired. As we talk about his hopes of starting a country inn, I have the odd and overwhelming feeling that I'm talking to another woman. He is a cowboy, very taciturn and masculine, yet I can't shake the feeling. When I finally get up the courage to say so, he says, "Of course, that's because I was raised as a girl." Then he tells me this story. I tell you from memory, it isn't the kind of story that you can forget. I grew up in a family that lived outside of town, in a big old house in the desert. There were three generations of us. I knew my grandfather was also my father, and he was also my mother's father, but I didn't know there was anything wrong with that. What I did know and hated was that whenever we stopped for gas and didn't have enough money, my mother or some other relative would send me into the gas station to do a blow job for the guy who worked there. I don't remember when this started. I was maybe 4 or 5, but I had learned to do this sexual service for my grandfather. He used to say that I should have been his granddaughter. Maybe he felt strange about doing this with a boy. My mother began dressing me in girl's clothes and calling me a girl's name. When I went to school, I wore boy clothes, but I didn't have friends. I learned right away that ours was the family other families told their kids not to play with. As soon as I was old enough to run away, I lied about my age and joined the Navy. I felt safer than I ever had at home. Getting out was the first thing that saved me. By the time I came back home and rented a room in town, there was a women's center where groups talked about a lot of things, including sexual abuse in childhood. I had no idea this had happened to anyone else. The therapist there explained that once women started talking to each other, they discovered that this happened a lot, especially but not only to girls. When survivors needed help but couldn't afford therapy, this therapist helped them form a group, and I joined. It was six women and me. I discovered it wasn't my fault. But when people in the town knew we were telling family secrets, even the Women's Center had to turn the therapist out. Still, she kept on meeting with us on her own. But what really saved me was what you felt. I had dressed and lived as a girl until I was about eight, so I never felt I was a man like my grandfather. As my therapist put it, I never identified with the aggressor. If I had, I might have become an abuser myself. It's terrible to be a victim and to believe sex is the only thing you're worth. Without help, girls grow up to keep believing that. But some boys start abusing other people because that's a way of being a man. That means guilt, being afraid you'll get arrested if you tell the truth, cutting off all empathy, everything that makes it harder to get out. I wouldn't say I was lucky, but it would have been worse if I thought I had to control and abuse other people. He is telling me his story to say thank you. Because the women's movement was born of women talking to each other, childhood sexual abuse was revealed to be a fact, not a Freudian fantasy, and children began to be believed. We finish our coffee. He is a rare person, a man who knows what it is to be a woman, and also someone who has ended abuse in one generation. I thank him for surviving and teaching. There are many kinds of lessons on a campus. It's 1995, and I am at the Dominican College near San Francisco. Because an outdoor amphitheater on its campus holds 1,000 people, it is about to be the site of a fundraiser for Planned Parenthood. No one has uttered a peep of protest. Planned Parenthood clinics have provided health care for so many for so long that it has become one of the most trusted organizations in America. Even some anti-abortion protesters seem to have figured out that demonstrating against clinics only turns public opinion against them, especially since just 3% of Planned Parenthood services are related to abortion. But this is the calm before the storm. Archbishop John Quinn of San Francisco writes a letter to the college's president condemning me as a leading advocate for virtually unrestricted abortion in the United States. Though the college gets not a penny from the Catholic Church, it was founded by Dominican nuns long ago. They are no longer around to speak for themselves, but the archbishop says their legacy is being betrayed. Everything just keeps going, both the accusations and the event. Some contributors do indeed withhold their funds from this college, which is hurtful. But when the trustees hold firm to their support for free speech on campus, new contributions make up for the loss of the old. If anything, the archbishop has only brought more media coverage of an era of declining church membership, aging priests, shutdowns of a dozen historic churches, the revelations of sexual abuse by priests, and many other troubles that caused him to be summoned to the Vatican for a tactical consultation. On the day itself, I'm impressed to see a small protest plane circling over the amphitheater pulling an anti-abortion banner. Someone yells out, "Look, the right-to-lifers have an Air Force." There is laughter. The event goes right on. Even though I know this lonely little plane is a commercial one that can be hired for birthdays, weddings, and advertising, the symbolism of its constant circling makes me sad. Talking later to Dolores Huerta, my friend of 30 years, a lifetime organizer of farm workers and efforts to elect progressive women, I tell her that I can't shake the sadness of this symbolic distance between an airplane representing the church and the real lives of women on the ground. She reminds me of the organizer's mantra, "Roots can exist without flowers, but no flower can exist without roots." Religion may be a flower, but people are its roots. 3 months later, Archbishop John Quinn retires at the age of 66, 9 years ahead of schedule. San Francisco newspapers report that he was too distant from the people. In rural Oklahoma, where oil wells grow in fields next to cattle and winter wheat, I'm talking with the university auditorium full of students in a post-lecture discussion. Most people are trying to figure out how to make their daily lives more fair, whether it's who gets tenure or who gets the kids ready for school. But I noticed that an all-white group of 20 or so people in Jesus t-shirts are not taking part. Finally, a young t-shirted man stands up to protest my support for legal abortion, which is odd because we haven't been talking about abortion at all. He says abortion isn't even in the Constitution, so how can it be protected by it? A female college student who looks about 12 rises to say that women aren't included in the Constitution either, but now that we're citizens, we have reproductive freedom as part of a constitutional right to privacy. If the Founding Fathers had included Founding Mothers, that freedom would have been in the Bill of Rights to begin with. The crowd applauds. I can see we've reached the magical point when people start to answer each other's questions. I can just listen and learn. An older man who seems to be the leader of the Jesus t-shirt group says that the Bible forbids abortion in its commandment, "Thou shalt not kill." But being in the Bible Belt, people really know their Bible. And an older woman cites Exodus 21:22-23, a passage that says, "A man who causes a pregnant woman to miscarry must pay a fine but is not charged with murder, not unless the woman herself dies." Thus, the Bible is making clear that a dependent life is not the same as an independent life. This quiets the t-shirt wearers, but probably not for long. I can see them conferring. Meanwhile, another student rises to object to parental and judicial consent laws that treat a young woman as if she were the property of her parents or the state. "If you're old enough to get pregnant," she says, "you're old enough to get unpregnant." A man chimes in, pointing out that if a woman serving in the military is raped by another soldier or even by the enemy, she can't get an abortion in an army hospital or anywhere with government funds. She's not even guaranteed a leave to find one on her own. There is a rumble of disapproval and learning. A nurse arises to explain the metal bracelet she is wearing. It looks like the prisoner of war bracelets that bear the birth date of a loved one, but she explains that hers bears the birth and death dates of Rosie Jimenez, the first woman, but not the last, to die from an illegal abortion because the Hyde Amendment forbids not only the use of military tax dollars, but health care or any tax dollars for abortion. Rosie was on welfare, only a few months away from graduating with teaching credentials so she could support herself and her 5-year-old daughter. But she got pregnant, crossed the Mexican border to get an illegal abortion, the only kind she could afford, returned to Texas, and spent 7 painful and fevered days in a hospital being treated for septic shock, at hundreds of times the taxpayer's expense of an abortion. She died, leaving behind her daughter and a $700 scholarship check that was proof of Rosie's promising future. This happened only 2 months after the Hyde Amendment went into effect. Hundreds and perhaps thousands of women have lost their health or lives since. With an eye on the t-shirt group, I explain that reproductive freedom means what it says and also protects the right to have a child. A woman can't be forced into an abortion, just as she can't be forced out of childbirth by sterilization or anything else. The women's movement is as devoted to the latter as the former, including the economic ability to support a child. It just seems lopsided because the opponents of safe and legal abortion have focused there. I hope the Quiet T-shirt group might be realizing that this protects their choice, too, that government, with the power to forbid birth control or abortion, could also enforce one or the other, but no such luck. Suddenly, they stand up in unison, chant, "Abortion! Murder! Abortion! Murder!" and walk out en masse. In the silence that follows, I can feel people trying to figure out what went wrong. I too wonder what I could have said or done. I express my regret at their walkout, which seems to break the spell. A young white man in jeans, slender, shy, perhaps in his late 20s, raises his hand and begins a story that seems unrelated. He has invented a new kind of bit for oil rigs. He just sold the patent and received an unexpected amount of money. He He would like to donate $90,000, about half of his windfall, to the cause of reproductive freedom as a basic human right, like freedom of speech. There is silence, then laughter, and then cheers. Never in my 4 decades of traveling and fundraising will anything like this happen again. If people pledge money, it's usually after an appeal and in requested sums. Also, they tend to give according to what others are giving. To me and to everyone in that room, this young man has shown how to give without being asked and according to ability. More than ability, since he is sharing a rare windfall. He has given us all the gift of spontaneity and hope. We stay in touch. He comes to New York and stops to say hello. When I'm on another trip, a young woman introduces herself to me as his sister. When he and I cross paths in Denver, we have breakfast. Every few years, the road seems to bring us together. That day in Oklahoma became a landmark in all our lives. For me, talking and organizing after a campus or any other lecture is the big reward, because then I am learning. We often continue in a restaurant or campus hangout or just sit on the nearest available floor. With a shared lecture to respond to, plus my request to overcome the hierarchical setting and pretend we're all sitting in a circle, even if there are 500 or 5,000 of us, people get up and say things they might not say to friends or family. It's as if the audience creates its own magnetic field that draws out stories and ideas. I also read aloud from notes handed to me by the audience about, say, cuts of hard-won new courses that aren't yet in the core curriculum, but plenty of money allocated for a new football stadium, because I can do this without punishment. Often a kind of alchemy takes place. When someone on one side of the hall asks a question and someone on the other side answers it, I know this magic has happened. The group has acquired a life of its own. There are rock-bottom subjects for men as well as women. If there is one that men want to talk about most, it's how much they miss having nurturing fathers, or any man in their lives who cared. Once they delve into that, the question is how to become that father or man themselves. This childhood wish is one of the greatest allies that feminism could have. Men also talk about seeing their mothers treated with violence or humiliation by fathers or stepfathers. I've watched the biggest, baddest-looking college athletes with tears rolling down their faces because they were remembering how they felt while witnessing their mothers being beaten. Whatever the makeup of the audience, I've learned to have faith in the smart, funny, revelatory responses and the surprises of a discussion that usually goes on longer than the lecture itself. I wish I could bring you 1,000 YouTube videos of people standing up and asking what they need to know, or sharing what they've learned, or telling their stories, or asking for help, or saving me from some impasse I can't solve. A sample? At a law school in Canada, we are deep in a discussion of the law as a universal instrument that feminists should not expect to be flexible. I am arguing that this is what judges are for. Otherwise, justice could be meted out by a computer. The mostly male law students are arguing that any exception is dangerous and creates a slippery slope. Make one exception and the number will grow until the law will be overturned de facto. I'm not a lawyer. I am stuck. Those young men may or may not represent the common sense majority in the audience, but they have triumphed. Then, a tall young woman in jeans rises from the back of the room. "Well," she says calmly, "I have a boa constrictor." This quiets the audience right down. "Once a month," she continues, "I go to a dissection lab on campus to get frozen mice to feed my boa constrictor. But this month, there was a new professor in charge, and he said to me, 'I can't give you frozen mice. If I give you frozen mice, everyone will want frozen mice.'" There is such an explosion of laughter that even the argumentative young men can't resist. She has made her point. Not everyone wants the same thing. A just law can be flexible. To be just, a law has to be flexible. She has saved the day. At a community college in California, an auditorium full of returning women students is into a long and serious discussion about how difficult it is to get their male partners to share equally in the housework and childcare. It's not just because the men are resistant. It's because the women themselves feel guilty or don't want to seem like nags or don't know how to divide work and childcare because they've never seen it at home. One woman rises to speak. Close your eyes and pretend you are living with a woman. How would you divide the housework? There is a long pause. Now, don't lower your standards. There are cheers of approval. On another campus, some women tell me about men who leave their underwear on the floor and don't feel compelled to pick it up, or even notice. By now, the shouts and laughter have become quite rowdy, and I've begun to worry about a silent young Japanese woman near the front. Perhaps we are offending her. As if summoned by my thought, she stands and turns to face all 500 or so women. "When my husband leaves his underwear on the floor," she says quietly, "I find it quite useful to nail it to the floor." Amid laughter and cheers, this shy young woman seems surprised to find herself laughing too. She tells the group this is the first time she has ever said anything in public. In a discussion of the advantages of having younger men as husbands and lovers, because they're more likely to treat women as equals, one woman rises to say, "Of course they understand better. We were their mothers." Once again, I worry about a much older and ladylike woman in a front row who looks disapproving. When I ask if we are offending her, she rises, turns to the audience, and says, "When you are having an affair with a younger man," I notice she doesn't say if, but when, "try never to get on top. You look like a bulldog." This remark, coming from an unlikely woman, but one who had clearly been there, brought down the house. If there is one thing that these campus visits have affirmed for me, it's that the miraculous but impersonal internet is not enough. As in the abolitionist and suffragist era, when there were only 600 or so colleges with 100 students each, and itinerant organizers like the Grimke sisters, Frederick Douglass, and Sojourner Truth traveled to speak in town halls, granges, churches, and campgrounds, nothing can replace being in the same space. That's exactly why we need to keep creating the temporary worlds of meetings, small and large, on campuses and everywhere else. In them, we discover we're not alone. We learn from one another, and so we keep going toward shared goals. Individual organizers in the civil rights movement had a network of black churches, not just phones and mimeograph machines, and veterans speaking against the war in Vietnam had coffee houses and rock concerts. Now that there are at least 4,000 campuses with more than 15 million students, not yet diverse enough, but more diverse than ever before, they are the mainstay for wandering organizers like me. I recommend trying this kind of grassroots organizing for a week or a year, a month or a lifetime, working for whatever change you want to see in the world. Then one day you will be talking to a stranger who has no idea you played any part in the victory she or he is celebrating. You'll learn that, say, students and staff and faculty created childcare that changed who could go to a college, or that the best qualified candidate got elected instead of the best financed one, or that high school students here worked summers to pay the school fees of their counterparts in Africa, or that a governor learned about wrongful convictions, including of women who killed their batterers in self-defense and commuted the sentences of everyone on death row, or that male executives insisted on parental leave and equal time with their kids, or that an entire state rose up against turning its prisons and public schools into corporate profit centers, or that domestic violence became grounds for firing police and police brutality plummeted, or that a school system ordered texts that covered all the continents and populations equally, or that American history courses actually began when people first populated this land they called Turtle Island, or that gun ownership went down and public transportation went up, or that reproductive freedom became the fifth freedom and other hopes that only you and your future self can imagine. Then, as if in answer to a riddle posed years before, you will realize that this growth came from seeds you planted or watered or carried from place to place, and you'll be rewarded in the way that we as communal beings need most. You'll know you made a difference. Chapter 5. When the Political is Personal. My mother's stories of suffering during the Depression and how Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt helped us out of it taught me that politics are a part of daily life. She described making soup from leftover potato skins, then listening to Roosevelt's speeches on the radio to nourish her spirit, or cutting up a blanket to make a warm coat for my older sister and protecting her from ridicule by saying that if people loved a new kind of first lady, they could love a new kind of coat. She even told me that my grandfather had died not of pneumonia, as everybody said, but of a broken heart after losing everything he worked for. Had he lived to see President Roosevelt create jobs and dignity where they were needed most, by building bridges, planting forests, even painting murals in post offices, she was sure he would be with us still. It made perfect sense to me that my mother's stories began in a personal place and came to a political point. So did her belief that Franklin and Eleanor understood our lives at the bottom, even though they were born at the top. Always look at what people do, as my mother said, not at who they are. She also was sure the Roosevelts wanted us to become independent, not dependent. Since, like most children, I said things like, "It's not fair, and you are not the boss of me," this idea made me love them even more. Not all my mother's stories had a happy ending. When I saw a mysterious newspaper photo of police dragging dark-skinned people through city streets, she explained there were race riots in nearby Detroit, because the Depression had never ended for people called Negroes. I imagined people making soup from potato peelings and coats from blankets, yet somehow I couldn't imagine my family being attacked by police. She also sat with me as we listened to a radio drama about a mother and child trying to survive in a place called a concentration camp. I knew my mother didn't want to frighten me, only to teach me something serious, and this made me feel important and grown up. In later years, I wondered if she meant such small doses of hard realities to immunize me against the depression that, in her, could be triggered by as little as a sad movie or a hurt animal. Yet I never asked why my happy-go-lucky father had zero interest in politics. Both were kind and loving, just very different. I was 11 when President Roosevelt died. By then, my mother and I were living in the small town in Massachusetts where we had moved after she and my father separated. I can still see the exact look of the cracks in the sidewalk where I was riding my bike when my mother came out to tell me. It was hard to believe that Franklin and Eleanor would no longer be part of our lives. It was harder still when I realized that not everyone was sorry. Some in that town blamed the president for getting us into World War II. And others thought his idea of a United Nations would just let foreigners tell us what to do. A newspaper cartoon said, "Goodbye to President Rosenfeld." My mother explained that no, Roosevelt wasn't Jewish. It was just that prejudiced people linked together things they didn't like. Our only companion in mourning was an elderly man across the street who wore a tie with FDR woven into it, something he showed to us as if to co-conspirators. My mother was brave enough to put a black-draped photo of the president in her front window, but not brave enough to explain it to the neighbors. I was beginning to suspect that conflict follows politics as night follows day, yet the mere thought of conflict was enough to depress my already depressed mother. I myself cried when I got angry, then became unable to explain why I was angry in the first place. Later I would discover this was endemic among female human beings. Anger is supposed to be unfeminine, so we suppress it until it overflows. I could see that not speaking up made my mother feel worse. This was my first hint of the truism that depression is anger turned inward. Thus, women are twice as likely to be depressed. My mother paid a high price for caring so much, yet being able to do so little about it. In this way, she led me toward an activist place where she herself could never go. My own political life didn't begin until my last year in high school. I was living with my sister in Washington, D.C., where she was a buyer in a department store and shared a house with three other young working women. They assumed I must be homesick, and it seemed disloyal to tell the truth. Because I was responsible only for myself, I was in heaven. In my new high school, everyone seemed headed for college. Some had even taken the college boards before, just for practice, something I'd never heard of. They came from families with bank accounts instead of pay envelopes, dinner parties instead of TV dinners, and vacations in countries my Toledo friends' families had fled in poverty. Many of my new classmates came from high-level military families and regarded presidential candidate Dwight D. Eisenhower as war hero and father figure combined. To me, Adlai Stevenson, a reluctant candidate drafted by Democrats, sounded more like Roosevelt, but I wasn't about to argue. I had a handsome new boyfriend who was headed for West Point, the son and grandson of generals. Only by accident did I discover that a makeshift Stevenson for president office was just a streetcar ride away. The minute I walked into that big room full of ringing phones and rushing people, I felt it was the most exciting place I'd ever been. Staff members were presiding over cluttered desks, volunteers were talking intensely while stuffing envelopes, and teenagers were stacking lawn signs for nearby Maryland and Virginia, where people could actually vote for president, unlike residents of D.C., who were supposed to be neutral. Most amazing, all this was open to anyone off the street. Soon I had a place working alongside other young women volunteers, getting purple ink on our hands while tending a big drum-like mimeograph machine churning out Students for Stevenson. It was a newsletter designed to attract volunteers, since no one under 21 could vote. I could see there was a clear hierarchy. Male staffers made decisions, and women carried them out, even women old enough to be their mothers. Paid staff were white men, and the few black women and men were volunteers or messengers. Still, this was much more like the real world than my new high school. I spent my first days there trying to figure out why the halls full of students looked so odd. Suddenly, I realized that everyone was white. I asked a teacher if this reflected the neighborhood, and he said, of course not. It reflected segregation. Washington was two separate cities, he said, and the black majority wanted separate schools, too. Besides, the city had come a long way since slaves built the White House. This was news to me. My Toledo High School was segregated socially, too, not only by race, but by whose family had a television set, spoke Polish or Hungarian at home, or had a father who was a foreman instead of working the line. But at least we all went to the same classes, ate in the same cafeteria, and cheered the same football team. Altogether, this Stevenson for President office was the most open and welcoming place I'd ever been. But one Saturday, when I and the other young women arrived, we found ourselves stashed away on an upper floor. We were devastated. A staffer explained that Stevenson himself might drop in and must not be seen with any female unless she was old enough to be his mother. After all, he was that terrible thing, divorced, something no president had ever been. Though everyone seemed to know that Eisenhower had imported the beautiful young English woman who was his driver during the war and even arranged for her U.S. citizenship, he would have his wife, Mamie, as a proper first lady. Appearances were all that mattered. We didn't object to being hidden away. We felt like typhoid Marys who might endanger the cause we cared about. When we went out for 10-cent hamburgers at the local White Castle, we talked about staying out of sight. What we didn't talk about were the male staffers who raided our looks, brushed against us in close quarters, and became hazards to be navigated. Our presence was the problem. Their behavior was inevitable. Avoiding them while keeping their egos intact was just part of our job. The truth is that we would have put up with almost anything to stay in this exciting place, with its air of fighting for outsiders, even though we didn't yet know we were outsiders too. Or, to put it another way, we didn't believe we could ever be insiders. I didn't know that political change could make me feel safer in the street or allow me an identity of my own instead of marrying it, or send my Toledo classmates to college instead of to factories, or get my current classmates out of their white ghetto. I didn't realize that changes made through politics might have helped my